This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Jonathan Bennett and I talked to Paula Hunter of Mojo Loop. We talked to her a year ago, and we're going over all the progress is made in the meantime, and especially on the topic of digital public goods, plus everything surrounding that. What Mojo Loop does is a foundation. There's also an open source project working with the less developed world on whole new ways to do transactions that are cheap and affordable and based on open source, and will reduce the number of readers that people have to deal with at retail counters and many other side effects besides that. It's a really interesting project, and that is coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 726, recorded Wednesday, April 5th, 2023. Mojo Loop and digital public goods.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club TWiT. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club TWiT Discord, a great clubhouse for TWiT listeners. And finally, the TWiT Plus feed, with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.
Hello again, everybody, everywhere. I am Doc Searles. This is Floss Weekly, and I am joined this week by Jonathan Bennett himself, there Doc. In the chair that makes him look less tall than he really is, because it's huge.
Indeed. It's good to be here.
Yeah, great. And everything fine? You got with your enlarged family in Oklahoma there?
Yeah, doing pretty well. Took about a month off. I told everybody my wife is due in March. I'm probably going to be gone for a while. We've gotten that taken care of. Baby is out and doing relatively well. A few things to work through, but that's all right. We're doing well.
You always have those. I spent time yesterday with in our new neighborhood here with the family across the street, which is a husband, wife, and a three-year-old who really, really, really wants to explore the street. They're yelling at him, stay on the green, stay on the grass, stay on the grass. Being a three-year-old boy, he doesn't do that. He takes that as advisory, mm-hmm. not a command. Anyway, so yeah, you've already got at least one, right?
I've got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and we are working that process and various different things. No, that's not the thing you were to do. That is okay.
And they are not the same. Oh my God. They're all different.
Yes. We were talking about that last night. My wife is working on doing some preschooling, and she was telling me things that she is struggling with him. And I'm hearing my own mother's voice echoing in my ears things that she complains that I did when I was growing up. I'm like, I'm so sorry that I gave you a mini me.
Our youngest, who's now 26, but he could walk at 9 months. He was a talker early on, and like not much over a year, he toilet trained himself, and then after that decided he didn't like that. He just preferred the diaper for like the next 3 years. Like, dude, you can talk. We can negotiate this. No, he wasn't doing that. It's like, wait a minute. The others all knew, you know? And
yeah. Oh, kids are crazy. Marriage is crazy when they're that young. Goodness.
Anyway, well, the adults are too. So,
well, that's true. Yeah.
Have you done any homework on this one for today?
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure I caught the show live last time when we talked about Mojo Loop. Done a little bit of looking into it since then. And I have some questions, and of course we're going to do a checkup on where it's gone and what's happened. But from what I understand, it's all about letting people do banking with nothing more than a cell phone, and not necessarily a smartphone, you know, not an Android like most of us have in our pockets here in the States. But, you know, in other countries, the feature phone is still popular in some places. And from what I understand, maybe remembering the wrong show, I suppose that's always possible. We've done a bunch of them. But from what I remember, Mojo Loop is all about letting people take their feature phone and have access to banking. And it's an open source project to really enable that. And that's neat. And I'm like I said, I've got questions, and I'm real curious about where it's gone in the intervening time since we talked to him last.
Well, that is awesome. And I did not re-listen to the last show, but I did dig a bunch. So we'll hopefully I'll remember enough also from the last show. So Paula Hunter is our guest. She's the executive director of the Mojo Loop Foundation, a charitable nonprofit focused on extending financial inclusion. The efforts of the Mojo Loop open source software project. So there's the foundation and the project. She leads the organization's strategic planning and direction, grant, membership, strategic partnership, a bunch of other stuff, evangelism. She's an open source and technology leader with nearly two decades of executive director level experience, managing industry advocacy groups, open source organizations, standards organizations. She was tapped by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to develop the plan and structure for the open source based Mojo Loop again, and which they successfully launched in 2020. And she's also has extensive experience with United Linux. I actually have to scroll down while I'm reading this because it's so long and well put. And it's a consortium of open source vendors funded by IBM, HP, and other technology companies. So Paula, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. And for those of you watching, really, really good camera there and a good mic. We always like that. So tell us, look, you've got the foundation, you've got the open source project. Tell us how those two fit together, and especially whatever sort of outline what's happened since the last time we talked was a little over a year ago.
Yeah, so in the last year, what we've really been trying to do is focus on deployments. Of course, we have to keep the open source project vibrant. We need to continue to grow the community, but we also need to get deployments in the field. And as I mentioned in the last call, our focus is developing countries, particularly in Africa, parts of Asia. We have a new opportunity in Mexico right now. But in markets where the banking infrastructure is not nearly as sophisticated as we see here in the States or in Europe, and there's at least 1.5, if not 2 billion unbanked or underserved citizens that we're trying to reach in new ways. And so while the open source project continues afoot, we have a extensive roadmap and work streams that are iterating. Now we've shifted more of our activities to market focused. So we're talking a lot more to the central banks, the regulators, and the whole ecosystem that is involved in rolling out a Mojo Loop deployment.
So Jonathan, you want to ask about the phone thing?
Sure. Yeah, I can go earlier into that.
Yeah.
So now I'm just going off of memory here, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it is all about tying finances with a cell phone or a cell phone number, right? Isn't that the basic idea of Mojo Loop?
Well, the basic idea is to provide the plumbing that banks and other financial institutions can use to transfer money to its citizens. And yes, the most logical form factor is going to be a mobile phone. As you mentioned, Jonathan, these are not, you know, high-end smartphones, they're feature phones. And in Africa and other developing markets, a lot of them are Android-based, but they're not Samsung or, you know, high-end platforms. They're very low-cost phones, and so very accessible to those folks that may not have internet access at home, may not have any access to a local bank branch. So that's the way in which that banks or other financial providers, whether it be a microfinance entity or even a government agency that wants to dispense aid, the best and most logical route to that citizen, except with the exception of cash, of course, would be to a mobile phone.
So that handoff just a second ago was a little rocky because I had a memory spark and I was searching for it. And I found it. So there is a story that Jeff Bezos tells. And this happened, well, he tells the story years ago because obviously he's much younger in the video clip. But the story happened in 1995 when Amazon was first got started. And he tells the story of one of their first customers paid with cash in 95 and was someone that lived in Bulgaria. And they took two $100 bills and they folded them up and they put them inside a floppy disk. and mailed the floppy disk to Amazon. And if I remember correctly, the explanation was, if I just send money in the mail, there are, you know, there's the corrupt people in my country, there's the corrupt people in the mail, there's the corrupt people in your country, someone is going to steal it. But if I hide it in this floppy disk, nobody cares about a floppy disk. And it actually made it through that way. And I think about that story, and then I think about how the rest of us pay for things on Amazon, which I'm sure everyone is like me, and you're tempted to pay for something on Amazon at least once a day, multiple times a day, probably. And just the difference it makes to be able to do that without having to worry about how am I going to get this piece of paper, this piece of cash over to, you know, where I need to make this transaction. And it really does seem like giving people a reliable way to do that is such a game changer for them, isn't it?
Yeah. And think about it also from the perspective, if you're not banked, you don't have a credit card, you don't have a debit card. So that whole venue is lost to you. So having some type of wallet functionality with your phone so that you can transmit money digitally is a game changer. And if you think of, you know, a woman that has a roadside stand, she has a microfinance loan to underwrite her inventory. She collects cash all day long. She walks 2 miles to a local exchange or a merchant to pay off some of her microfinance loan. She might want to send money to a sibling or another family member in another country. Anytime someone wants to take that cash and transmit it elsewhere, pay a bill, pay a utility, pay off a microfinance loan, give money to a family member, there's a transaction cost associated with that. And that woman might be making $100 a month. So every time there's a transaction cost for her to convert cash to some other form of payment, it costs her money. And when you're making $100 a month, that whittles away at it very quickly.
So, Paul, you just mentioned transactions. As it happens, I have a good friend who's way smarter than me and maybe even everybody, who really knows all kinds of things about finance and so forth and networking, and came out of the phone world, actually. And one of the lessons he has, and I'm not sure it's a lesson or not, is that there are always transaction costs, no matter what you're talking about. That even the internet, which has nothing about billing built in, for the most part in the world, is deployed through phone and cable companies, and they need to make money somehow. So somewhere downstream is always a transaction cost, even if an individual doesn't pay it. And one needs to be mindful of those things. So if I understand you right, when you've got a way there to avoid transaction costs or to reduce them to the least?
Reduce them, for sure, reduce them.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, a lot of cases, there's so many intermediaries that you can't do it all through one interface or through one network. So you're hopping on and off across different platforms. And again, there's a cost associated with doing that. If a central bank can implement an integrated instant payment system, everyone can use the same rails, and you're not trying to find different competitors that will provide you services for a much higher fee than if you use the backbone that your central government has employed.
So I have what I suspect is a dumb question, but I want to ask it. You mentioned digital currency. We're not talking about something like Bitcoin, are we?
No.
What's the difference? Okay, where does that, how does that play in? What are we talking about when we say digital currency? And how is that different from the world of Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I may have misspoken. I'm trying to imply digital transactions, where you might have currency in your wallet and you want to send it to someone else's wallet or account. It's not crypto. It's not a digital currency or a central bank digital currency. It's fiat currency. And you're just making that transmission as you do, you know, if you're trying to transfer funds from one bank account to another account. It's not crypto. It's an electronic transfer of funds. So that's what we're trying to facilitate there. Not to say that you couldn't use my MojoLoop as the infrastructure for a central bank digital currency or a cryptocurrency. We don't care what form the currency is in or what currency it is, for that matter. What we want is there to be an authenticated transmission process and settlement of one currency from one account to another account.
So does Moja Loop tie into the Swift system, the whole Swift payment system? That, from what I understand, that is kind of the digital transaction system that the whole world uses.
Well, the whole world, except if you're unbanked, you don't.
Well, it's fair.
Right. But yes, well, we have the APIs to plug into Swift for currency transfers. But again, we don't deploy Moja Loop. A central bank or a major bank deploys Moja Loop. And then they use our open APIs to plug it into other legacy systems, if you will, so that they can tap into all the other pipelines that they use to transmit funds.
So you jumped ahead of me. Let me get one more in, Doc, because she half answered the question I was next going to ask, and that is Moja Loop is the project. It's not the deployment. Let's talk for just a second about some of the places that you've seen deployments. And I think the three of us are all in the United States. Is there a place in the States? Is there a bank using Moja Loop in the States? Where's the closest one?
No, our center of gravity is Asia and Europe and Africa. We don't have any people on the ground promoting Moja Loop in the United States. We're trying to use Moja Loop to penetrate markets that have no other options available to them. Anyone's free to use Moja Loop in the United States, but you know, I have zero business development people focused on US. Our most recent deployment, which I mentioned the last call, is in Tanzania. So the Central Bank of Tanzania implemented what's called their TIPS system, Tanzania Instant Payment System. And they knitted it together with 45 or so other financial institutions in Tanzania. So everyone's using the same plumbing to transmit funds, make merchant payments, and the like. So they rolled that out in Tanzania. They just went live in the past 6 months. So that was the first instantation of Moja Loop. Another one that I mentioned on her last call is a project called WinePay that's in Myanmar. Now that's ready to go live, but they're awaiting regulatory approval. So the Central Bank of Myanmar didn't implement this project. Another consortium of financial institutions have created a platform called WinePay, and they're just waiting for regulatory approval to flip the switch. We also have new projects that are starting in Rwanda, Mexico, Guinea. So I Mexico is a outlier in that, yes, that's North America, not Africa or Asia. But they found us, they found our story compelling, and the solution works for their needs. But it's important to point out, you know, to the open source folks that are listening in, Moja Loop, yes, is an open source project. We don't sell or deploy Moja Loop. We rely on the local ecosystem of systems integrators and solution providers to deploy it. The people that typically would deploy Moja Loop are a central bank, a national bank, or some other digital financial service provider that wants to roll out new instant payment functionality to existing customers or potential new customers. So back to your original question about the United States. No, we don't have any deployments in the U.S. and are not, you know, actively seeking them. We're really trying to address markets that have a shortage of financial services out to the unbanked and underserved.
Okay, so I'm interested in how you sell this. Okay, you said it's all locally deployed, but it's the banks and financial institutions that are using Moja Loop to create new solutions, get new customers, make retail work, that kind of thing. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, so you're dealing mostly with them. Do you pitch them? Do you contact them? How they find out about you and come back? Do they watch the show? By the way, we're a worldwide show. We're not just, we're only open source, but we're everywhere.
Yeah. So I would say that Moja Loop ends at advocacy and education. And what we do is work in market. Like, for example, we do workshops. We recently did one in Rwanda where we brought in local systems integrators that have expertise in financial solutions and fintech sector. And we train them on Moja Loop, not only to deploy it, but to help sell it. And so it's an opportunity for solution providers in country to add to their portfolio an open source offering that they can sell services, maintenance, operational support around. And then they go to the central banks and the financial institutions. In some cases, they bring us in to talk about the project and its history. I'm happy to do that. But we're a nonprofit. We don't sell anything. So we have to really depend on the local market, because that's the other thing is, particularly in developing countries, they're used to big actors coming in from offshore, and they want to be more self-sufficient. So with us spending time in target countries, developing skills and capacity with the systems integrators and solution providers, when a big entity is ready to roll, some of their major gaps in a deployment is skills and having the capacity to do the deployment. So the systems integrators come in and provide additional skills and capabilities to help the bank design, implement, and deploy the solution. So it's a complex, very complex sales cycle. I won't minimize that at all, because the other factor that we have in play in developing markets is oftentimes the government doesn't have the money to do the implementation. That said, there are a lot of philanthropies out there that fund or provide loans for infrastructure projects. And in most cases, this is Mojoloop is considered an infrastructure project. And so what we do then is we play matchmaker with the local government with aid agencies that might have infrastructure funds to help support the deployment. So that adds, it's not your typical procurement cycle that you would see with a proprietary platform in a developed market. It's a tad more complex, and therefore the sales cycle is much longer.
So you mentioned system integrators, and that's a term that was like really big in the 80s and mm-hmm. and the 90s, and when we had NetWare and stuff like that were out there. What are system integrators like in the environments where you're working? Are they one person shops? Are they several person shops? Are they, independent operators?
No, they're usually bigger than that. We're looking at folks that have a customer base, have proven projects they've deployed before. There's kind of a fuzzy line between them and some of the fintechs that are trying to create custom services and solutions for the marketplace. If you go back to the whole Red Hat model, I mean, what is Red Hat? Were they a software company? Were they a solution provider? They were taking Linux and wrapping their services around it to deploy in large institutions. We're basically looking for mini Red Hats, companies that have a set of skills and understanding of a market sector, finance, and can help implement and deploy a fairly complex solution. So it's not a one or two person shop. In most cases, they're much, much larger than that, but not necessarily. And they may be cross-border. They may be multinational, but maybe not international.
It's interesting. On our back channel, somebody said that here system integrators basically means somebody who builds PCs. I don't know if that's still the case, but that's probably what they were back when. Now, this is kind of a side question, but we had somebody from this on the show not long ago. In India, there's a new system called Beckon, BECKN. Are you familiar with that at all?
No, I'm not.
And if you're not, just put it in your radar then. But let me jump sideways into another topic, because you mentioned wallets. The Open Wallet Foundation has been created by the Linux Foundation, which is mm-hmm. the foundation that spawns foundations, which just makes things even yeah. more confusing. And I joined it because I felt like they needed somebody who actually used a wallet rather than made a wallet. But I'm wondering, are they on your radar? Are you involved with that at all? Or is that a little too highfalutin further up the stack or elsewhere? I'm not sure. More of a first world problem.
It seems to be more of a first world problem at this point in time. Again, if you're an unbanked or underserved individual, where are you going to get your wallet from? Right now, it's going to be in a local in the local market, in a probably a banking institution, maybe a mobile network operator. But how the front end is implemented, so the wallet functionality, that's really determined by the service, the entity that's providing the services to their consumer. So they're going to choose whether or not they have a plug and play wallet, a vanity wallet for their own branding, or use some other capabilities. But so we're more ambivalent about how it reaches the consumer. We want to make sure everything flows. And so that regardless of what the wallet is on the receiving end or the disbursement end, that our system provides the necessary rails for the money to flow.
So I have a different angle that I want to run down here just for a minute. It's kind of technical. But let's start with this. So it's tied to a cell phone. Does MojoLoop does it use actual text messages? Is it based on GSM?
Again, that's up to the implementation party to just determine what technology they want to leverage.
Okay.
But in many cases, they can use text messages. From a merchant standpoint, they might use QR code scanning. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on the use case and how the entity itself wants to deploy it to their current customers and future customers.
Yeah, makes sense. I was thinking about GSM. So there's this saying with email that emails are as secure as a postcard because they generally get sent in the clear. GSM is a little bit better than that, but we've seen some attacks directly on GSM, but also SIM swapping has been very popular among, kind of the digital criminals over the years. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, what is built into MojoLoop to keep it secure? How does that work when it's using something like GSM or QR codes, both of which seem to be kind of very postcard-esque?
Yeah, well, now you're getting into the technical underpinnings and how the institution deploys their know your customer rules. And so again, they are in control of that, not MojoLoop. It's not sexy, but we're the plumbing. We make sure that the funds transmit back and forth between many different systems and end user experiences. So we don't dictate the end user experience. We want to make sure that the transaction is secure when it leaves the bank and when it is received by the recipient. But the recipient's wallet is secured by whatever service provider they're working with.
Got it. All right. So one of the things that kind of got whispered into my ear is the idea that maybe there are some lessons that the unbanked world has learned and can teach the developed world. What's some of the flowback that you guys have seen that maybe we can learn from some of the places you've done deployments in?
Wow. What's interesting is, we're walking into a lot of situations where there is no legacy, right? So you can start fresh. So they don't necessarily know what the pitfalls are of developed countries in how they've deployed instant payment solutions, because this is all greenfield for us and for them. Mm-hmm. So they don't have necessarily the perspective of how it's been done in the past, because they've never offered instant payment solutions in the past. So we're starting with a whole new set of technologies, and we're also starting with the assumption that the consumer relationship is different than what you see in developed markets, where people may rely on their bank branch, although that's starting to shift, of course, as people become more in favor of online banking. But that banking relationship that we experience here in the States, or even our relationship with a Venmo or PayPal, does not exist in developing markets. The challenges in developing markets is how do we reach potential, I hate to even use the word customers, recipients. I mean, so like there's a really important push for government aid payments. particularly to migrant workers and refugees. How do you access those people? That's not a Mojo problem. That's a, you know, that country's problem. How do they reach migrants? How do they reach refugees? How do they reach citizens that are unbanked? And that's part of their challenge that the commercial sector in the U.S. and other markets has resolved through, you know, the historical bank branch model, but now the online experience as well. Bear in mind, in these developing markets, data is expensive. You know, mobile phones are cheap. Data is expensive. So they may not be able to do the same type of advertising and promotion to a mobile phone in a developed market that you would see here in the States. Everyone's, you know, online 24, a lot of people are online 24/7 and have, you know, unlimited data on their phones. It's a different marketing push to get out to those types of citizens.
It very much reminds me of the early 2000s when eBay first became really a thing that entered the public consciousness. And then you had PayPal. And boy, I have memories of back in the day, generally my parents buying things and always seeing this, you know, PayPal preferred or only pay with PayPal. And it really strikes me that there are some parallels there. That, you know, we went through kind of this digital revolution in the 2000s with how we, in some ways, banked and bought things online. And it kind of seems like Mojo Loop is bringing that same revolution, but now, of course, tied to smartphones and to more people. But there are some parallels there, aren't there?
Oh, for sure. And you know, what techniques have been used in the past to reach potential customers is of course, important to learn from, because there are ways. I think we talked about this on my last call about the mobile network operators. You know, of course, if someone has a mobile phone, they have some type of relationship with an operator, even if they've gotten that phone through a merchant. And so how do we leverage that relationship? How does the bank leverage that relationship? We had a project underway in Africa. It was a joint venture between Orange and MTN to roll out a Mojo Loop instance. The problem was the regulators didn't like it. They don't want the mobile network operators getting into the banking business. So there's still some regulatory evolution that needs to occur that allows other players to enact transactions between customers and not require them to be a bank, because that was a barrier to moving that project forward with a captive audience of you know, mobile phone users. So it's unfortunate that, you know, that'll come over time. It's just that, you know, the regulators need to become more comfortable with this concept of it's not just the banks that can transact these types of, you know, activities.
So I'm struck by a thought there that there's some bootstrapping that has to happen. You know, someone has to have a phone to be able to use one of these Mojo Loop instances, but you've got to pay for the phone. But once you have the phone paid for, you're probably going to want to use Mojo Loop to continue paying for the phone. And so there's this kind of cash-based bootstrapping that has to happen before you can get into the Mojo Loop. To get the Mojo Loop mojo started for you.
Yeah, for you. Well, you know, and right now when they go to get a phone, they buy it for cash, and if they need to top it off, they go to a local broker or agent, and they carry cash to that shop and say, you know, top off my phone. So right now it's all very much cash based, mm-hmm. But there's a lot of inherent problems with cash, but it's you know, everyone understands that as a mechanism. What we're trying to do is get people access to new ways to pay off their microfinance loan rather than walking 2 miles in the dark carrying a wad of cash. Not exactly the safest way to pay off your microfinance loan.
I'm wondering, I'm remembering from friends working in Africa that, and this is a few years ago, that M-Pesa was a big part of how economies worked there. And I'm trying to remember even what M-Pesa is, and I'm sure you know, I see you nodding, so I know you know what it is. So fill us in if there's any connection between M-Pesa and and what you're doing with Moja Loop and where the carriers involved?
Yeah, so M-Pesa has been particularly successful. It's a Vodacom initiative, proprietary, and closed loop. So if you don't have Vodafone, you can't participate in that digital economy, if you will. If you are in markets where M-Pesa is deployed and you are at a merchant that is M-Pesa enabled, then you can exchange transactions with that merchant or with another peer for peer-to-peer payments in, from phone to phone. The problem is, because it's proprietary, the transaction costs can be high and they're under the control of a commercial entity. It's not an open loop, which is Moja Loop. Moja is Swahili for one loop for all. What we want to be able to do is see folks cross over and not have to care whether or not someone has a Vodafone deployment, Vodacom deployment, or Orange or MTN or Central Bank of Rwanda, that any of those different types of systems can talk to one another. You go into some merchant shops in some countries in Africa, and the merchant will have 6 or 8 card readers because the platforms are not interoperable. So they have to buy a reader if they want to accept a certain card. And so that's a cost to the merchant. And then, of course, if you happen to have a card that merchant reads, you pay a transaction cost as well. Yes, those merchants are offering it as a convenience, but it's complicated. I mean, you have to stop and look and determine which system you think your credit card will be accepted by. Now, if you're local, you probably use the same one every time. But if you're a traveler, it's totally perplexing.
So Moja Loop.
EMVCO took care of that, EMVCO took care of that in U.S. and Europe. And
what elsewhere. Did? I'm sorry.
EMVCO. They're the standard by all the credit card companies use, so that you only have one reader when you go to the grocery store.
I was not aware of that. I just sort of thought something happened.
EMVCO is a very, very powerful organization that is a collaboration of all the major credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, Amex, et cetera.
Yeah.
There's a reason why we no longer have magnetic swipe or getting rid of it in the United States.
So were they the ones that finally decided that we could have chips and cards 10 years after they had them in Europe or 20 years after they had them in Europe?
Well, you know what the problem was is the merchants didn't want to pay for new readers.
So the card
companies were taking on all the credit, all the fraud risk. So when the card companies said, okay, if you want to continue to do a mag swipe at your store, the risk is now on you. If you get a chip reader, we will take on the risk. And that's how they moved the market. The credit card company said, we're no longer going to underwrite the risk for magnetic swipe. It's too expensive.
Wow. And it's too easily wiped out inside your credit card as well, because you put it next to your watch or something that has a magnet in it. So, would I be right in saying, is it sort of a, not a summary, but a way of making sense of what you're saying, that you actually run a kind of reader reduction program for points of sale? Is that right?
I mean, ideally, yes.
Does the word Moja Loop percolate down? I mean, you've got a B2B sell in a way, but when ordinary citizens start seeing fewer readers at a store, will they know that Moja Loop made that happen?
Probably not. No. Mm-hmm. Probably not. I mean, obviously we'd be delighted if the banks and financial institutions leveraged our brand, but they're very proud of their own brands as well. So I don't think it's likely. Why don't you know who EMVCO is, right?
Yeah, there's just going to be a tiny little footnote on a web page somewhere powered by Moja Loop.
That's okay.
So I'm curious whether there's been a lot of problems from regulators. And you touched on this just briefly, but maybe this isn't as much of a problem in developing countries as it would be in first world countries. But pretty much any time, particularly when it comes to finance, something new is being introduced and pushed, there always seems to be some pushback from regulators. And, to some extent, that's an appropriate thing because you're talking about messing with people's money. And so that's why those regulators are there, right? Is to keep changes from happening too quickly and from too many things from going underwater and all of that. But is that been a problem, or is that just you consider that part of the process when trying to do a rollout?
Both. It is a problem. It's a challenge in that you introduce something new, people are skeptical. They want to know that it's proven, that other people have dallied with this new open source trend. And I've had to reset my own talking points with regard to open source for the developing marketplace. My experience with Linux goes back 20 years. And so I take for granted the benefits of an open development model, of a collaborative community, of the security implications of having that collaborative community and many eyes on the code. That's all new to developing markets. So I've had to kind of dust off the old value proposition of open source in these developed markets. I mean, a lot of them use Linux, but they don't really understand the open source development model. Right. And where it becomes most impactful is if we can get the regulators involved with our community. So we do 3 to 4 community meetings a year, usually in Africa. We did one in Kigali, Rwanda, back in March, early March. And we invited regulators and bankers and central banks, and we had probably representatives from about 10 countries. And what they saw in, for a week is technical experts in the area of payments that are deploying open source software, that are enhancing and maintaining Mojolu. And as they talk to these people, what they realize is the depth of expertise that these individuals have, and the fact that they can tap into that expertise just by being part of the community. And then they start realizing, so this is how they iterate the product development cycle for Mojolu. They come together 4 times a year with their community. The community can include regulators and bankers and systems integrators and tech companies. And they prioritize the requirements and the features and functions that we want to address for the next program increment, the next development cycle. So that's their opportunity to feed into the roadmap without opening up their checkbook and saying, please build these features for me, as they would for a proprietary software offering. Yeah. So as they witness this evolution of the project, in real time with the developer community, they start to realize the inherent benefits of the open source development model. It's very hard to convey that, with just slideware. So when we can get them involved with either a handful of open source developers or our community when we have those meetings, it's kind of an aha moment for them because they realize I can be part of the solution. I'm not just the customer. I can expand on what my requirements are, what my issues are, and there's likely to be like-minded individuals in the room that have the same problems. And guess what? I'm not going to have to pay to maintain that either. If I stay on the Mojolu core and don't fork it, this community will test it, integrate it, and maintain it. And again, I'm not writing a check to a software company for that. So they start to realize the total cost of ownership benefits of the open source way. It's not just about the fact that it's a free license. It's the lifetime usage of the open source code base that provides incremental benefits as they use the code.
I am going to try forevermore to, instead of saying PowerPoint presentation, to just call it slideware. I like that a lot. So do you get much return in kind? So do you get patches from your integrators, the different deployments? Have the people behind that kind of now started to plug back into the community and push fixes, push new features? Or is it pretty much all flow One Direction.
Yeah, it's early. Right now, it's more One Direction. But we do now have a product council. And what we've been doing is inviting the early deployment participants into that product council to talk about the feature set, the functionality, performance, how do we need to enhance it. So getting market requirements is very valuable to the developer community. What should we prioritize? What should we be working on? And so that's the first part of the contribution, is let us know what your needs are and what needs to be fixed or enhanced. The next step would be, oh, and by the way, if you've done this work yourself, share it. And then we will help maintain it for, we'll test it and maintain it for you. But I mean, I was at a conference in New York City recently with Finos, which is the open source fintech arm of Linux Foundation. And, you know, they talk about contribution. And they've got Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, all the big brands there in the room. It's still taken them years and years to get contribution back from that, of those companies that are accustomed to being the customer. So again, I think having these community meetings in their backyard, having them rub elbows with developers, we'll get there. But, you know, our priority right now is making sure that we enhance and extend the current offering in a way that meets the broadest set of needs for the marketplace. The contributions will come over time.
So we've actually managed to go 45 minutes while covering all new territory, I think mostly from our last conversation more than a year ago, and we still haven't touched DPGs, digital public goods, which is what was said in your prep document. So let's go there. What exactly are digital public goods? Because it seems to me like that is, as a three-word acronym goes, a DPG, I think that sounds great, but what are those?
Well, they're organizations that somewhat emulate open source projects and foundations, but it takes it a step further in bringing them to market, typically in government-led initiatives. So one that I'm pretty familiar with right now is MOSIP, which is a digital ID initiative. So it's a public good, and it's really targeted at governments that want to implement digital IDs. And the characteristic of these DPGs, whether it be Mojoloop or MOSIP or NIFOS, there's this alphabet soup of DPGs out there now, is that we're not commercial actors. Our code is available to everyone. It's open source, globally available. And the governments and the aid agencies that typically fund these types of deployments want to ensure that we adhere to these non-commercial principles. And that as we develop and enhance and extend the offering, we remain focused on public good. Big difference in the United States from a tax code standpoint, I'm a 501c3, so I'm for public good. Linux Foundation is a C6, which is for vendor good. It's for an industry and a consortium. So they can do things that derive specific vendors' benefits to their vendors. I can't do that. Everything I have to do is for public good. And so what's happened is more and more organizations, there's the Digital Public Good Alliance that is trying to create a foundation and a directory of DPGs to help governments navigate this whole new collection of software offerings in most cases that are, you know, their foundation are open source, but they are being targeted and deployed in most cases by government agencies, central banks. They're often funded by philanthropic organizations like Gates Foundation, UNCDF, Rockefeller Foundation. Again, there's an acronym soup of entities that provide that kind of funding. But I've been talking with the different executive directors of DPGs about what are the barriers to success. And you mentioned the regulatory challenges, Jonathan. You know, getting to the regulators and making sure that they understand it's not just Mojoloop that you can avail yourselves of. There's a whole collection of digital public goods that you could use in your government agencies rather than going down the proprietary road. The other thing is, you know, the World Bank in many cases has historically funded a lot of these big infrastructure projects. Well, open source licensing doesn't fit the procurement model that's been, you know, deployed, you know, internationally for these types of infrastructure projects. So collectively, the digital public goods are going back to the World Bank and saying there needs to be a procurement model for open source projects, because there's still money needed. It costs money to deploy an open source solution. These aren't shrink wrapped offerings. So the bank may need, you know, people to write the rules and the governance structure for this, for the Mojoloop instance, someone else to scope out the infrastructure requirements and build out the infrastructure, someone else to customize or tailor the solution for that particular bank's needs. All of that is money that goes out the door. And, you know, World Bank and other philanthropies often fund these projects, but they need to recognize that it's not the traditional proprietary approach. Because in a lot of cases, our competitors in the proprietary sector, they take the lead in advocating for their solution with the bank. The bank makes, you know, does an RFP, and the major players come in and respond to that. It's a whole different model of DPGs. The good news is that it opens up opportunity for local players to participate, who are often locked out because they're not big enough. They don't meet the requirements of the World Bank. But it's a process that we all collectively are going through. There's a new organization too called CoDevelop, which has built up a fund to help mitigate some of the deployment challenges that we're finding in these countries and help advocate for DPGs more generically rather than, you know, me as my own entity advocating. So it helps in having other major players out there in the marketplace talking about open source, talking about DPGs, breaking down these longstanding principles in the procurement model. I spent a lot of time talking about the business side of Mojoloop rather than the technology side. That's almost the simple part, is pulling together the code base and going through a traditional software development cycle is pretty well understood and something we can replicate over and over again. It's breaking down the business barriers and the regulatory barriers that require some work. So we're really, on the cusp of a whole new way of these developing countries to deploy technology in market. And so when you're new, there's, you learn, there's challenges, there's awareness, there's education that's required. And so we're trying to do it more collectively now, rather than everyone out trying to, break down these barriers independently.
So I want to jump in with a couple of quick questions. The first one being, when you talk about a DPG, I'm reminded very much of a couple of other terms, and I'm curious if they're synonymous. And that is a corporation for the public good or a public benefit corporation. Are those examples of DPGs, or are we talking about two different things?
Yeah, we're really talking about tax code. And so those terms don't necessarily resonate worldwide. Digital public goods is more of a, I'm thinking UN CDF came up with that acronym some time ago as a way to characterize these types of offerings, whereas the terms that you used really have more to do with your tax base. As I mentioned, we're a C3, so we're digital public good. Mm-hmm.
So a DPG refers
we're a public good.
Right. So a DPG refers more to the offering, the yes. technology itself, the piece of software, yeah. not necessarily yeah. the organization behind it.
Right.
Okay.
But, there are requirements to be listed as a DPG mm-hmm. With regard to, the fundamental characteristics that the Digital Public Goods Alliance articulates are non-rivalrous, non-excludable, and globally available, which, ideally, one would hope that you could see that that happening with most open source foundations. But, once you start getting into the commercial players that are advocating for technology that's funded by Google and an IBM, et cetera, some of those requirements fall by the wayside.
Sure. And then the other thing that comes to mind is when we talk about kind of this struggle to really to break into this to use a very business term, to break into this new market. I'm reminded of a bunch of stories of open source back in the early days before businesses really knew what it was. And there were two things that you would hear that would happen all the time. And that was somebody in the business wanted to use this new open source technology, but legal said, you've got to pay for it. So there had to be some way to pay for it, even though it was open source. And then the other story I've heard several times is business deploys it, business loves it, and wants to send money back to the open source project. But again, legal says, we've got to have an invoice to be able to send money. And so, you know, the integrator at the business would get a hold of the developer at the open source project and say, hey, we need you to send us an invoice for this amount of money so that we can cut you a check to be able to fund your project. And the open source guys would go, we don't make invoices. We don't know how to make invoices.
Oh, I can invoice. Kind of,
yeah. My thought was always, man, give me a piece of paper and a pencil. I'll make you an invoice if you want to send me money.
Yeah, I understand the problem because we're not allowed to sell services and solutions for profit. I can sell a membership in the Mojoloop Foundation that helps underwrite our operations and activities. I can also get funding for certain specific projects on a cost recovery mechanism. So that can be done, but I haven't heard that be a roadblock thus far. What I have heard is skepticism in market that open source, because it's free, will undermine business opportunity with local systems and solution providers. And what I've had to remind them is, yes, I'm funded by philanthropies to offer this software for public good, freely licensed. We're not asking you to deliver your services pro bono. You should be charging market rates based on the skills and expertise of your company to design, implement, and install a Mojoloop instance. So there is market opportunity. You just don't have the burden of the license fee on top of all that. Because, it's solution providers that thought we were trying to undermine them, you know, with a free offering. I can't deliver it. You know, I can put it on GitHub and let people download it. But, Mojoloop Foundation doesn't provide the services to deliver it. And again, it's not, as I think you've probably gleaned, it's not a trivial, pull the shrink wrap off and install it on your server type of offering. It's far more complicated than that. And so... there is business opportunity, and we're not trying to bring in the top five systems integrators from around the world to do your deployment, central bank. We're trying to build up expertise in country so that you can spend your dollars in country and have a local resource pool that can support your solution on the long term.
Yeah. Go ahead, Doc.
Oh, no. Finish your thing, and then I'm going to...
Oh. I was just going to comment that it sounds like all of these stories and then the ones I told about business and open source, it's kind of the same process. Like the whole idea of open source, everybody's very skeptical of it at first. And there's education and really just a time of proving. Like people have to see that, yes, this does work. And we did it back in the 90s and the 2000s with open source and business here in the States. And it sounds like you guys are very much forging a similar path with DPGs and rolling out to these underserved places. And it's fascinating to me to see kind of that story repeat itself in another way.
Yeah.
There's a connection here, and I just found it, and I put it in our own back chat here. There is a Digital Public Goods Alliance, they have a blog, and on the blog in February, they note that the Open Source Initiative is the newest DPGA member. So that's more connection there, between different things.
I'm going to call Simon.
I was going to say that we should have had Simon in on this. He's very involved in all this kind of thing. He's another one of our team of co-hosts.
I'm still a member of OSI, so I'm quite
familiar. Fantastic. Yeah, so you probably know Simon then. So we're getting pretty close to having to wrap this, I'm just going to throw this out there because it's a former FCC chairman told me once that the one thing that most lawmakers don't, the two things that most lawmakers don't understand are technology and economics. And here you are trying to deal with that. And, but I think in a part of the world where people are actually much more resourceful and therefore more likely to know about these kinds of things. Is that the case? I mean, it's when times are tough, people get smart. And I'm thinking that you may be in a seller's market for MojoLoop in those cases. Is that right?
We're still addressing some of the same hurdles that we saw 20 years or 15 years ago with open source. Is it safe? Is it secure? I don't understand how it's maintained. So there's still an educational process. Once they get it, then they understand why some of these proprietary vendors that are knocking on their door are going to lock them into something that's usually benefiting someone offshore and is going to be very costly over the long term. Because there's very few, you know, MojoLoop offerings in the marketplace. And the ones that I know of are proprietary. Probably the biggest one is a company out of Russia. And so there's all kinds of baggage right now with sending your money to a Russian company to handle your money transfers. So as they get educated, they see this opportunistically, but this that educational cycle is still required. Open source just isn't mainstream yet in these markets.
So I do want to ask, just before we close, there's a question I like to ask everybody because we get really interesting responses. And we may not hear, but we may. What is the most surprising thing that you've seen someone do with MojoLoop? Like, what deployment is the most innovative or just unusual that you've seen?
It's the one in Myanmar. I mean, this is a situation where, I mean, the government is, you know, there's chaos in Myanmar right now. Mm-hmm. And it was the Agricultural Farm Bureau in Myanmar that said, we need to be able to transact business with farmers in rural locations. So it wasn't a bank at all. But, you know, they have to be able to transact with farmers, probably for them to purchase seed, but also for them to sell commodities. And so they're using MojoLoop to implement this. And, you know, in retrospect, they probably didn't think they needed banking regulatory approval, but because the transmission of funds, the regulators in Myanmar are requiring them to go through those last steps for regulatory approval. But, you know, that was, for all practical purposes, it's not a banking implementation at all. But microfinance companies, are they banks? Well, you know, they're really loan companies, right? They don't have the same regulatory requirements as you know, Bank of America or name the bank in Africa. So that's the other thing is the regulators are starting to have to deal more and more with non-traditional banking type institutions.
Now I wish I'd asked that question sooner because there's an entire different direction that we could go with that conversation about what happens in a failed state and all of that. And we are way too far out of time to get into any of that.
Yeah. Well, this is save up for next year. I think I asked you, we ask everybody this and you may or may not have an answer for it because has not been an especially technical show, but what are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Yeah, you've asked me that. A text editor, whatever the source document was created in. I'll be honest, I've been on Windows for all my career. I've had an Apple Mac, and I'm dyslexic when it comes to Mac. It's just, everything's opposite. So,
Linux. So,
I was a Lotus 1-2-3 person from way back, so I still know those keystrokes. They're just embedded in my brain. But really, I'm totally ambivalent. It's whatever's sent my way. And I don't code. So, the whole, editor issue is different for me. It's more just getting a document out.
Clearly on top of your deal. And you're running a great project there. So thanks so much for being on the show. This has been fantastic.
Oh, my pleasure.
We'll have to have you back again. in another year, because you're in a very active area there and we're expecting progress.
All right. Well, I'll look forward to it. Thanks, Doc. Thanks, Jonathan. Yeah.
So Jonathan, that was a quick hour, considering that we even started early, ended a little bit later, and had no ads.
Yeah, goodness. It was fun though. I'm glad to be here to get to talk to her. I remember listening last time we interviewed her, but wasn't on. But it was neat to be able to cover some of that. At some point when we have Mojaloop back, of course we'll have to have her back. But it would be fun to talk to maybe somebody on the integration side, because boy, there's some technical things that I really wanted to ask. And it's like, oh, that's not the direction this conversation is going. So another time, it would be fun to dig into some of those technical questions. Although, like she said, so many of those vary based on deployment. So it's difficult to get, I suppose, globally valid answers on them.
Yeah, well, my own very admittedly limited experience in the less developed world, the big impression I always come away with is these people can be very, very, very resourceful, because they have to be. And this fits right in there. I think that we're going to see more and more innovation coming out of places like that, and projects like Mojaloop, I think, are going to be extremely helpful. But payments are just so essential, and transactions are so essential. They're the foundation of every economic system. I mean, you have relationships and you have conversations and you have other mechanisms that are present in a market, but unless transactions happen, nothing else is going on. Where things are more difficult or less organized or less federalized or some other thing like that, you get innovative solutions. So it's great to see this going on.
Yeah. And it's taking care of problems that we kind of take for granted here. And, people of a certain age just have no memory of what the world was like before, there was PayPal and there was your digital credit cards and online banking and all of those things. I mean,
I like the term people of a certain age referring to young people instead of people like me.
I'm just getting to be old enough that I'm starting to use that sort of terminology. But there are people alive today, there are kids alive today that may never really have any handling of cash. Who uses cash anymore? I carry a little bit around, but not a whole lot. Don't use it very often. And I don't know, it's just crazy to think about the different ways that people interact with that idea of payments and making transactions. How disparate that scale can be.
I remember when Microsoft organized a CD conference and heard somebody the other day, a young person, say, "What's a CD?" So we've already reached that point. So what would you like to plug there, Jonathan, so we can...
So two things. First off, Hackaday. You can't see it, but I write for Hackaday, and we have the security column go live every Friday morning. 282 articles. Goodness, been there for a while, apparently. do the kind of the security beat for Hackaday. Have a lot of fun with that. And then the other thing that we want to make sure and plug is Club Twit. It is the club. It is where all the cool kids are at. And it's only $7 a month. It's ridiculously affordable. And that's like a cup of coffee these days. I don't know that you can get a cup of coffee from a nice place for $7, but you can still get Club Twit.
We haven't inflated the price of Club Twit.
Yeah. So it's ad-free access to all the shows, but it's also three exclusive shows. There's Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show, hosted by yours truly. And if you want to take a look at those without going all the way into the buy-in, there's actually some free episodes of all three of those. And we have just recently, in fact, in just the past couple of days, published the first free publicly accessible episode of the Untitled Linux Show. So you can go to twit.tv, go to shows, pull up Untitled Linux Show, and there it is. You can check it out. And there is yours truly talking about the world of Linux. And it's a blast. We would love to have everybody come and join us there.
Yeah, it's a great program, and we have a very, very loyal and energetic audience. I said, we've been in business for like 16 years, 18 years, something like that, this show alone. I mean, Twit is a pioneer at this stuff. So thanks, everybody. And I'm normally queued up on what I have next week, and I'm not this time. So let me do this real quickly and see. Okay, I got it. Rand Hindy, the CEO at Zama, Z-A-M-A, data privacy with FHE.org. So that is coming up next week, and I will see you then.
You want to hear about the latest news happening in the tech world from the people who write the article, sometimes from the people who are actually making the news? Well, we got a show for you here at twit.tv. It's called Tech News Weekly. Me, Jason Howell, and my co-host Micah Sargent, we talk with some amazing people each and every Thursday on Tech News Weekly, and we share a little bit of our own insights in each of us bringing a story of the week. That's at twit.tv/TNW. Subscribe right now. We'll be right back.